nothing better than playing to an empty room. But I know there are three students that have out on school-related functions, so I gotta do the recording. And I'm not staying late for two people. All right. So I'm just gonna put this on the recording. Hopefully, people that were curious about the exam hear this. I did screw up on the exam. I put the wrong date in, so it did not open and engage yesterday as scheduled, but it will open tomorrow. So I expect you to take the exam at some point tomorrow from 8 a.m. until 11:59 p.m. And as I did send in my engage message, if I scan your essays and I detect AI, you will get a zero on the exam. So do not cheat this time around. The exam will include everything up until last class, not today. So today's stuff is where we're going to start moving ahead towards the final exam. So last class, I left off talking about McNamara. Secretary McNamara went back to Vietnam in October 1966 and had a coming to Jesus moment when he suddenly realized that there was no way the United States was going to be able to win the war, at least not the way that Westmoreland was fighting it. Why? Well, he saw no break in morale. He saw that Westmoreland's body count strategy was not working. So instead, he argued actual diplomacy, pulling back American actions, stopping the bombing, allowing the VC to participate in the peace talks, and ultimately to pull U.S. out at the end of the war. But, coincidentally, he also spearheaded the development of Project 100,000, which we talked about. Not only was McNamara influenced by what he saw abroad, but he was also impacted by what he saw at home. In the United States, there was a growing anti-war movement, and the hippies and the protesters were becoming violent. It got so bad that not only himself, McNamara, but no senior administrator, nor LBJ himself, could freely travel anywhere in the United States without being mobbed by anti-war protesters. It was blatantly clear that the U.S. popular opinion on Vietnam was changing. Yet despite this, many of LBJ's advisors, the closest advisors, rejected McNamara's epiphany. They wanted more troops. They wanted more bombing in North Vietnam. And they wanted more emphasis on pacification programs. So, LBJ decided to press on. But he was worried. Not only, if you know anything about the 1960s, were there peace protests erupting everywhere, but there were also many urban riots. Race riots were popping up around the country. There was very few cities in the United States that didn't see some type of outbreak, including Boston. Plus, LBJ was becoming worried about the economy. Because he never shifted the economy onto a war footing, the United States was engaged in what's called deficit spending. Essentially, they were spending more money than they were bringing in. And how do you do that? Well, with loans. Plus, he was also spending massively on welfare programs. And he did not raise taxes. So, all of his policy objectives were hurting. And if the president's popularity plummeted, so did the likelihood that the Democrats would maintain control of government. So, rather than trying to fix any of the problems, LBJ, once again, as he had done with the Honolulu conference, decided to have another photo op. To boost the morale of the nation, he would travel to Manila and participate in a three-day conference with the United States and many of its allies who had committed troops to fight in South Vietnam. In attendance were many of the CETO countries, Australia, New Zealand, the Philippines, South Carolina, even Thailand. And all of these members were committing troops. We really haven't talked about it, but some of the fiercest allies in the Vietnam War for the United States were the South Koreans. The South Korean Marines were absolutely terrified. Terrifying. Because they hated communists. So, by showing this united front, LBJ was trying to tell the American people, look, they're not there by themselves. Because after all, if we can't sell the war to the American people are going to turn on the war. And we're not going to be able to fight. I would ask if there are any questions, but I'm guessing there are none at this point. Well, once the Manila conference concluded, he actually secretly got on a plane and flew to the Republic of Vietnam. He would land at the United States Air Base at Cam Ranh Bay. There, he had a huge photo op. He came onto the back of the military transport, spoke to the troops that were on the base, and he proclaimed that his administration would never let them down. And in true Texas style, LBJ urged all of the young men there to nail that coonskin to the wall. But South Korea sending 50,000 men, the Philippines sending 4,000 men, Australia sending 7,000 men, New Zealand sending 600 men. That wasn't enough. Because Europe, Europe did not support us in Vietnam. Why? Well, after the Gulf of Tonkin incident, when the United States ratcheted up, escalated the war, LBJ never bothered to tell the Allies what we were doing. So as a result, all of the nations in Europe, while they didn't publicly oppose it, none of them were willing to send a single soldier or a single penny. And coincidentally, as it would turn out, France actually began to criticize the United States, which of course is ironic, because the only reason why the United States was in Vietnam was because of the French. But why didn't our allies commit? Well, truth be told, recent declassified communications showed that there were political leaders in West Germany and England that had contemplated coming in. They were interested, but they were all terrified of their own people. So they were afraid if they got bogged down in a war, they would basically lose office. So
essentially the United States continued to fight, but they were fighting alone.
North Vietnam, on the other hand, they were getting plenty of help. Both the Soviet Union and China were pouring in money, bullets, guns. But the two communist powers were having differences of opinion in terms of whether or not Hanoi should negotiate. Moscow repeatedly told Hanoi, just negotiate with the United States. Just end this war. But Beijing, on the other hand, kept telling Hanoi, now keep fighting, keep fighting. Kill all the Americans. Because China wanted revenge for Korea. But despite the differences of negotiations, both sides wanted North Vietnam to win. They wanted the United States to be humiliated. Because they believed if the United States was humiliated, then their influence globally would increase. So as a result, LBJ stayed in the war. He was completely outmaneuvered. And even worse, for all sakes and purposes, we were doing it alone. FYI, the total deaths in 1966, 6,350. That number was 3.3 times higher than the casualties in 1965. So yes, we're killing more VC. We're killing more North Vietnamese soldiers. But we also have more flag-draped coffins coming home. Would have liked to have gotten to that last class, but we ran out of time. All right. What about 1967? Well, truth be told, which is the same as 1966. Westmoreland sent the same reports to LBJ in 67 as he did in 66, like I talked about. Essentially that the enemy is being hurt bad, but it's still not beaten. We just need a little bit more troops and we can win the war. Coincidentally, all of Westmoreland's military plans were the same for 67 as they were for 66. Big war tactics, big war movements. And the United States would basically do most of the killing. But in 67, Westmoreland did include references to the ARVN. But they were to engage in pacification. So the Americans would sweep through, drive out the VC, then the ARVN would come in and take control. Well, to achieve this, the U.S. also engaged in massive operations. For example, Operation Cedar Junction. This was a 3-week operation that involved over 30,000 American soldiers. Operation Cedar Junction would focus on what became known as the Iron Triangle. That was a region just northwest of Saigon, and it had served as a massive Viet Cong staging ground. But, just like what we had talked about previously, when the United States rolled into the Iron Triangle, the VC didn't fight. They simply fled across the Cambodian border. But in efforts to stop the VC from coming back, the Americans then, with the ARVN, rounded up the entire population of the area. All of the men, the women, and children were basically rounded up and moved out of the Iron Triangle. And their homes were burned to the ground. And their fields were sprayed with Agent Orange, a powerful defoliant. But several months later, after the United States had pulled out, the VC came back. Then in the second half of the year, Westmoreland would launch what became known as Operation Junction City. This was an 82-day operation, also involving 30,000 men. The intent of Operation Junction City was to be a hammer and an anvil approach. They would begin with a massive aerial bombardment. And paratroopers would be dropped into the area. That would be the hammer. And then as the VC scattered, there was hopes that they would run right into infantry units, which were pre-positioned. That would be the anvil. Well, the significance about Operation Junction City was where it would take place. It would take place in the Tainan province, which was believed to be the location of the VC headquarters. Now, U.S. military command believe that the VC had a base there like the Pentagon. Essentially, that it was a huge complex, that they had staff, including secretaries, that there were file cabinets, that they had desks. But coincidentally, after the war, when the Viet Cong would actually reveal that their headquarters actually only consisted of a few men that were constantly on the move. They never actually had a base. So, what did this mean? Simple. I gotta take this. Hello? 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 Someone there? I know what it's about. That's a notary doing a closing that I'm supposed to be on call for. But they just must have rang the phone. And what?
So they probably wasn't answering.
No, no, they're there. I can hear them talking in the background. But they must have put the phone down on the table.
Oh.
No big deal. I'll deal with them later. All right. So anyways, as I was saying, Operation Junction. So Westmoreland, his intelligence believed that there was this big base that they were going to be able to go in and capture, but there was no base. And ironically, the VC knew the United States was coming because of spies. So, all of the intelligence that the headquarters, quote-unquote, had was simply put in guys' backpacks, and they all was transported across the Cambodian border. But, this time around, they left 15,000 VC in the province. So as the Americans moved in, the VC would launch 6 attacks and inflict huge losses on the United States, which of course caused the Americans to respond by unleashing hell. Airstrikes, artillery, armor were all involved. And in the end, casualties were high. On the VC side, they suffered 2,700 killed in action, plus there were 34 POWs and 162 defectors, whereas the Americans suffered 282 killed in action. These massive operations, and there were more, did not actually turn the tide of the war as Westmoreland had predicted. Why? Well, simple. Movement. The enemy did not have big armies. The enemy had units everywhere. And they continually escalated their operations. But Westmoreland was absolutely convinced that the enemy was near its tipping point, or which he referred to as the crossover point, where basically they were losing more men than they could take in. But of course, even though he kept saying, we're on the verge of winning, he kept requesting more and more men. In April 1967, he requested that LBJ increase the total numbers of soldiers in country from 470,000 up to 550,000. Now, the irony was, is the 470,000 was the estimate of the highest amount that he would need from the previous year. And even in this, he told LBJ that the war would continue for another 5 years unless the United States increased the number up to 670,000. More men, more flag-draped coffins. Now, that's not to say that everything was bad. Truth be told, in the spring of 1967, LBJ continued to get mixed reports. For example, he received multiple reports from the CIA that North Vietnam was suffering from food shortages and that the NVA regulars were suffering from bad morale. But on the home front, as I said, the anti-war movement was gathering momentum. And then to make matters worse, in April of 1967, none other than Martin Luther King Jr. joined the anti-war protests, claiming that it was the United States who was, and I quote, the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. Well, you factor in Martin Luther King Jr., and LBJ has a huge problem on his hands. And then it got worse. McNamara again would create controversy when he released what became known as the Mid-May Memo. In this memorandum, he expressly admitted, and I quote, that there was no attractive course of action for the United States. He admitted that the big unit war was going well. We were killing lots of enemy, but there was no proof we were actually pacifying the country. Plus, Hanoi remained uninterested in negotiations. So he puts in his memo, and I quote, "The picture of the world's greatest superpower killing or seriously injuring 1,000 non-combatants a week while trying to pound a tiny backwards nation into submission on an issue whose merits are hotly disputed is not a pretty one." This memo gets sent to Congress. This memo gets read in hearings. This memo gets into the press. As was his recommendations. He recommended limiting bombing and cutting Westmoreland's call for more troops in half. Not 75,000, only 30,000. Well, this sparked not only a debate in the country, but it also sparked a debate within the administration. But it was the same split that we have seen going back to 65. The military leaders wanted more aggression, whereas the political leaders were starting to realize this is a lost cause. Question. Unfortunately, LBJ had no intention of losing. He had no intention of giving up on the war. He was absolutely convinced that Hanoi would have to negotiate. The amount of death, destruction that they were suffering was unfathomable. It had to be a matter of time before they would come to the negotiating table. But he also knew America's time was running short. In the summer of 1967, Gallup took a poll in which showed that LBJ, who once had a public approval rating in the 60s, had plummeted in popularity. 67% believed that LBJ was a failed leader. Although, admittedly, 50% of the war had no idea what the war was all about. And 25% believed that the Republic of Vietnam could survive with U.S. withdrawal. If you have a constitutional republic and you lose support of the people, you don't win office. Questions? McNamara's memo slips. There's debate going on. Public polls are plummeting. And as if that wasn't bad enough, another controversy broke out. The so-called order of battle controversy. This was downright scandalous. In assessing the needs of the United States, Westmoreland's command completed a list of their estimates of how many enemy was actually in South Vietnam. This is the enemy order of battle. According to MacVie, they concluded that at most, if you put the NVA plus the VC together, at most, it was 270,000 enemy soldiers in South Vietnam. But MACV did not include the auxiliary units, the support units. They only included what they believed to be the actual fighters. The problem is an army is more than just the frontline soldiers. An army is made up of the support units, the reinforcements. And it was this figure that Westmoreland was using to argue that they had reached the crossover point. Why? Well, the estimate from 1966 had the enemy at 300,000. So essentially, they believe in a year they've killed 30,000 more enemy than they've been able to resupply. And if you're killing more of your enemy than they can put on the battlefield, then you're winning. Sounds good. We got the momentum on our side. The problem was that the CIA, when they received the report, they didn't believe it. Why? Well, unbeknownst to Westmoreland, the CIA plugged in a spook, essentially a spy, to spy on MACV. This was a CIA analyst by the name of Sam Adams. No relation to the beer. Sam Adams was tasked with studying enemy morale. So what does he do? Well, he studied captured docks. Any documents that the Americans captured on the battlefield. Went through intelligence. Was involved in POW interrogations. And he also interviewed defectors. And based on all the data that he received from talking to these people, he, a few months after Westmoreland released his report, Adams estimates the enemy to be 600,000. Why? He included the support soldiers, the reinforcements, the staff. What makes up for this difference? Well, for example, Westmoreland included a Viet Cong dock, or failed to include a Viet Cong dock that showed an actual headcount. It was a roster in Binh Dinh County. According to the VC's own document, there were 50,244 men in the area. MACV's estimate only had it at 4,600. It's less than 10% of the actual numbers that the VC have on their roster list. So you multiply that across the country, and suddenly you have a 300,000 gap. And according to the intelligence he gathered, not only does he show the errors in the math, but he also uses eyewitness testimony to argue that what's in country now is just the tip of a funnel. He argued that the enemy could send another 100 or 200,000 men into South Vietnam in less than a year. So which was right? No. Before long, MACV and the CIA are battling against one another over the data. Who's right, who's wrong? Well, in the end, Westmoreland used his leverage in his friendship with the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and he basically gets CIA Director Richard Hems to revise Adams' numbers down closer to Westmoreland's. How can you fight a war if you don't even know how many of the enemy there are? And you can't even agree. The situation was not good. Questions? Well, in the end, as much as every president believes they can be an effective commander-in-chief, LBJ proved that he was not up to the task. Instead of demanding that the CIA and MACV figure out what number was right, he simply accepted the consensus. He also didn't hold anyone accountable for presenting what potentially could be miscalculations. So as a result, the administration is adrift. There would be no change of direction, and 1968 was an election year. But to make matters worse, 1967, because of the escalation, was the worst year to date. The end of 1966, the death toll was at, I can't find the numbers, I did read them today, 6,350. But at the end of 1966, that number doubled. 11,363 deaths. And as the body count spiked, so did the protests. How big were they? Well, on October 21st, 1967, over 100,000 protesters marched on the Pentagon. The group was so big that they managed to encircle the entire complex. And of course, all of the protesters taunted the guards that were inside, daring them to fight. But fortunately, none did. But as things were going from bad to worse, catastrophe would strike. The most significant event of the Vietnam War. On January 31st, 1968, Tet began. As the sun began to rise in Saigon, the residents were preparing to celebrate one of the most important religious holidays on their calendar. Tet is the Vietnamese New Year. The people of Vietnam celebrate Tet for 7 days. And there's dancing, and there's feasting, and there's noise making. The entire city comes alive. But at the same time as the residents are getting ready to begin celebrations, a secret squad of VC commandos approaches the U.S. Embassy in the city, center of the city. Now, I wish I had a picture of it, but I can't. I don't have time to continue adding pictures to this. But you can look it up if you're interested. And I can tell by your faces none of you are. Well, the U.S. Embassy was an impressive structure, 6 stories tall, shielded by concrete barriers. And standing in the middle of the compound was the building itself. Now, storming the gate was viewed as impossible. So the commandos assembly would blow a hole in the wall with explosives and then run into the compound. Now, U.S. military police officers, jarred by the explosion, immediately opened fire and killed them all. But much to the shock of Saigon, it wasn't just the one commando unit. Throughout all of Saigon and the rest of the Republic of Vietnam, over 80,000 VC soldiers went on the offensive. They hit 36 of the 64 provincial capitals. They had strikes in 5 of the 6 major South Vietnamese cities. They attacked all 64 provinces and attacked 50 of the hamlets, the protective hamlets. In Saigon itself, over 4,000 VC came out of the sewers, out of the alleys, and was seemingly everywhere. They attacked the palace. They attacked Navy headquarters. They attacked the Joint General Staff compound. Heck, they even attacked the state-run radio station. This was the first time in the war that the VC launched major operations in urban settings. And when they seized a block, or if they seized a district in the city, they stayed, they occupied it. They essentially was aiming to conquer it, which is something they had never done before. The Tet Offensive would mark a radical change in the war in Vietnam. How did it happen? Well, truth be told, the origins of the Tet Offensive date back to the summer of 67. Apparently, again, based on information that was released after the war, apparently Hanoi was getting worried that they were going to lose the war. Westmoreland was right. North Vietnam was actually reaching a tipping point. And Hanoi was getting aggravated with the commanding officer of the Viet Cong, General Nguyen Chi Thanh. He was the director of the Central Office of South Vietnam, which of course was VC headquarters. General Thanh was devising aggressive tactics aimed at countering Westmoreland's attrition strategy. He called this strategy, hold the enemy's belt, then hit them. The maneuver was designed to eliminate U.S. fire superiority. Essentially, the goal was to get as close to the United States perimeters of their bases and camps as much as possible. As close as through 100 meters. If you could get in close before you attacked, then that limited the Americans' ability to use their artillery or air support. Because essentially they would be right on top of the American soldiers. And by the way, in 1967, the United States deployed a lethal device known as Puff the Magic Dragon. This was an AC-47. It was a fixed-wing plane that was a gunship. In the door was an M-131 minigun, which essentially is a Gatling gun. And the M-134 could fire 200 rounds per minute. It was devastating. But again, if your enemy is right on top of your soldiers, you can't use that because essentially you would kill your own men. But General Thann's tactics were costly. This in part explains why throughout 1967, the VC death count was also increasing. Well, General Giap, who's the commander-in-chief of the North Vietnamese Army, apparently he began criticizing Thann's tactics, essentially claiming that this strategy of intensifying attacks and holding the enemy's belt and then hitting them was resulting in higher death counts, which was straining North Vietnam's ability to supply them. Giap was actually fearful that if the war continued, Hanoi could collapse. And if Hanoi collapsed, then all of Vietnam would be conquered by the Americans. Now, ironically, Thann would die of a heart attack prior to reporting to Hanoi. But with Thann gone, this is what allowed for Tet. It was a strategy devised by Giap, which the new VC leadership would endorse, known as General Offensive, General Uprising. The goal would be to strike at the Republic of Vietnam's government, not the United States. Because if you could topple the government in Saigon, the United States would have to withdraw. So, beginning in the fall of 1967, they unleashed this strategy. The first phase was to use the North Vietnamese Army and begin striking at positions along the South Vietnamese border. Giap knew if U.S. intelligence reported NVA activity, then the United States soldiers would go to the borders, away from the urban areas. So what kicked off on Tet was the second phase. Once the majority of the United strength was out in the jungles, then you attack the cities. They flipped the war. Now, coincidentally, Hanoi was inspired by events that took place back in American, Vietnamese history. Stuff that we talked about. Now, under GAP's plan, the final phase would occur on May 5th, 1968, which is when, through furthered consistent attacks, essentially the South Vietnamese government would crumble. And when the South Vietnamese government crumbled, ARVN soldiers would surrender and the United States would be alone. Now, of course, admittedly, Giap did not believe that that final step was going to happen. But see, Giap was mindful of what was going on in America. Giap understood his enemy much better than LBJ understood Hanoi. Giap knew that Americans were protesting the war. Giap knew also that there was a presidential election coming up. And Giap knew that LBJ would be in a vulnerable position. So Giap believed if we launch this Tet Offensive, it's going to force LBJ to negotiate. Which ironically is the exact opposite, but similar to what McNamara was saying. Questions? So how do you get the Americans to leave the cities and come into the remote areas? Well, I'll give you one of the most famous battles of 1968. The infamous Siege of Khe Sanh. Beginning 10 days before Tet, North Vietnamese regulars would launch artillery bombardments on an advanced military base at Khe Sanh. Khe Sanh was located in the northwest corner of South Vietnam, 6 miles from the Laotian border. But the base, territorially, was similar to Dien Bien Phu, the base that the French lost the Indochinese War in. Well, this base was located on a plateau surrounded by hills. The base was built to essentially monitor and break the flow of goods up and down the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And since 1966, an entire Marine battalion had been stationed there. They also built a massive airstrip. And since the spring of 67, the Marines had been doing sweeps around the base and engaging in bloody clashes in the hills. Casualties were high. But then, by August, as a result of the attacks, the only road to Khe Sanh, which was called Route 9, would be cut off. So now the base, like at Dien Bien Phu, could only be supplied by air. Then the United States started gathering intelligence. An intel report suggested that there was somewhere between 32 and 40,000 NVA regulars converging on the base. Now, how did they know? Well, by 1967, the United States had electronic sensors that they basically bugged along the trail. The sensors would set off signals that would be detected by aircraft flying at high altitudes. And the data of the signals would be interpreted by primitive computers, like a tabulation. So, when Westmoreland gets the estimate that there's like 40,000 enemy in the jungles, Westmoreland would actually send another 6,000 Marines, bringing U.S. total personnel up to 45,000. Then once he surged the strength, Westmoreland also planned to basically cut the enemy down by formulating what would be known as Operation Niagara. Niagara would be a massive bombing campaign. And coincidentally, it would be one of the most concentrated bombing strikes in the history of warfare. On any average day, over 350 strike bombers and 60 B-52s were flying overhead the base at Khe Sanh, pounding everything in the vicinity. In total, the Air Force flew over 9,600 sorties and dropped over 14,200 tons of bombs. Plus, the Marines flew their own aviation strikes, flying another 7,000 sorties, dropping over 17,000 tons of bombs. Plus, the Navy also flew sorties, flying over 5,300 sorties total, dropping over 8,000 tons of bombs. Now, based on the sheer tonnage alone, the estimates were that they had killed up to a third of the total VC soldiers operating in the area. But despite the payload, the North Vietnamese continued to strike Khe Sanh. The siege itself would last till June. By April, Route 9 was opened again. By May, the NVA stopped attacking the base. But soon after the siege was lifted, Westmoreland ordered the base to be completely dismantled. Every last thing of value was put on planes and flown out. And then when the last boots left the ground, they bombed the area just to make sure that there was nothing left. But this siege was costly. The United States would suffer almost 1,500 killed in action, and another 7,500 men would be wounded. Plus, nearly 1,300 ARVN would be killed. But we have no idea how many were wounded. In the NVA estimates, somewhere between 14,000 and 18,000. Now here's the irony. And this is why Tet was so sweeping. Why? Westmoreland did not believe Tet was the real offensive. Westmoreland was actually convinced that Tet was meant to be a distraction for the siege at Khe Sanh. Of course, we now know that the opposite is true, that the attack at Khe Sanh was supposed to be the distraction. But in the end, that in part explains why the Tet Offensive was so widespread. Questions? All right. At this point, because it's almost time to leave, we're going to call it a class. So we're going to come back. We're going to deal with the impact of Tet. We're going to deal with when the American press basically turned on LBJ. And then we got an election to talk about. So, we have class on Tuesday. We don't have class on Thursday because it's Easter break. Then we come back for, I believe, four more classes. And then you have your final exam, which will be a paper exam scheduled for May 6th, I believe. That's the Tuesday. Your paper is due April 22nd. Oh, and don't forget to...